Shrink Wrap Radio number 350, The Role of Nutrition in Mental Health, with licensed acupuncturist Dwayne Law.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dwayne Law, a licensed acupuncturist in the state of California, nutritional consultant and author, and we'll be discussing the role of nutrition in mental health. Dwayne Law, LAC, is an accomplished acupuncturist, naturopath, speaker, and author. He's among the earliest Westerners licensed as acupuncturists in the United States. He uses stories and rich visual imagery to show people how their bodies work and why things go wrong. He teaches simple, natural things anyone can do to regain health, stall aging, and get the most out of life. His company, Natural Stress Care, helps clients create programs that support their mental and physical health using the tools of complementary and alternative medicine. He's quoted as saying, "Most of us take better care of our cars than we do of ourselves. I'm writing an owner's manual for the body," close quote. He's the author of the book, Before Meds, After Meds, Complementary and Alternative Medicine for Anxiety and Depression. Now, here's the interview. Dwayne Law, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Good morning. How are you, David?
Well, I'm very well, thank you. And it's great to have you on Shrink Wrap Radio. As I recall, I first heard about your work when a colleague called my attention to a news item about a talk you were giving at UCLA. Does that ring a bell?
Oh, yes. That was just a little over a month ago. I was I gave a talk for the local chapter of NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill.
Oh, yes.
It was on nutrition in the mind. And we had a wonderful turnout, a very enthusiastic audience. There seemed to be a lot of interest.
Oh, that's great. And, of course, that's the topic really that drew my interest. Now, I have the impression that there might be an interesting story behind what turned you on to acupuncture and to healing in general. Would I be right about that?
Well, actually, you know, I am one of those healers who, you know, got my introduction to the field by being really messed up myself and not finding a solution, you know, through conventional approaches. And so having to go beyond them to see what else there was. Mom was a World War II nurse. And so there was nothing wrong with sugar. And, you know, the solution to pollution was dilution. I remember playing with mercury on the floor of my kitchen as a child.
Oh, I think, you know, I do, too.
You know, actually, remember
rolling
that?
Little,
you know, you
mercury balls around, rolling little mercury balls and around with your finger.
You could play with the spoon and everything. Yeah. So it was also, if we're of the same vintage, you remember when there was lead in gasoline.
Oh, yeah.
And my preschool was about 100 yards from the Hollywood Freeway in the midst of a valley, a very narrow valley. So I got to breathe a lot of lead when I was very young. And by the time I was an adolescent, I was a very angry young man, very, very angry. I won't go into details. I didn't get along with the kids at school. You know, I wound up in the hospital for being such a good basketball player. We don't need to go into that. But I had to be segregated. And essentially, it looks like I come from a family on the spectrum. You know, my nephew's been formally diagnosed. I've never been, but I certainly seem to have a lot of the signs. My father shows a lot of the signs.
The signs of what?
Of being on the autistic spectrum.
Okay.
Okay. I was self-medicating with sugar, you know, as a lot of children do, as a lot of people do. You know, we've found, you know, in the last, you know, couple of decades that pushes the dopamine pathways in much the same way that all addictive drugs do. And we can get into this a little later if you want. There's, you know, a growing body of evidence suggesting that sugar may very well be the first gateway drug. Well, I was a big sugarhead as a kid. And, you know, I mean, it's just lucky for the kids at my school that I found Alan Watts before I found Smith & Wesson.
Yeah,
really? I was really, really angry, and I was capable of anything. So even today, you know, when those poor kids go off with their guns in schools and everyone scratches their heads and goes, what could possibly be going on? What are these kids thinking? You know, in my mind, there's little doubt, you know, at least some of the time, what's going on.
Dwayne,
yes.
I noticed that it seems like your current work is focused on nutrition. Does that mean you've left acupuncture? I know we're going to be talking a lot about nutrition because we wanted to talk about nutrition and the mind. But I note that your original training was in acupuncture. How did that come about, and where are you with acupuncture today?
Well, let me just tie that together. I ultimately found out that sugar was poisoning me, and I was so astonished by this because it's so generally accepted. I thought, what else is there out there that I don't know about that uh-huh. could be useful? And eventually I stumbled upon Chinese medicine and acupuncture. Acupuncture is a very powerful tool, you know, and all the things that go along with it, Chinese medicine, the dietary ideas. The problem is that, you know, acupuncture is a service. And in the last 5 or 6 years, insurance companies, as you know, have cut back dramatically on their reimbursements for all kinds of medical services. And so it's becoming more and more problematic to operate according to old medical models, you know, fee-for-service kind of practice.
Yeah.
So I've moved into education
uh-huh.
as my primary clinical intervention. And, you know, the things we'll be talking about today are an example of that. I get very excited by helping people understand what goes on inside their brains, how that relates at times to the way they feel, and what they can do about it. And let me emphasize right at the beginning, none of this work is a substitute for psychotherapy, for good psychiatric work. I mean, you know, none of this is going to hold anyone's hand as they, you know, walk through life, helping them make sense of what's happening. It can't reframe issues. You know, it can't teach new coping skills. What it can do is extend the effects of all that work by creating a good milieu in the brain for optimal brain function.
You know, that was one of the things I appreciated in the PDF that you sent me of your book, was you start right off saying this is not a substitute for psychotherapy. And I just really, you know, as a psychologist, of course, I appreciated that. I'm not currently in practice, so I don't have that sort of vested interest. But I just thought it was a very sound and ethical stance. And the fact that you stated it right off out the gate made my interest and acceptance of what you had to say go up markedly. So, I should share that with you.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's sort of been astonishing to me as I've been making the rounds, giving talks and, you know, speaking to therapists. It's been a surprise to me how many assume that I think that it somehow is a substitute for what they do and that I'm competition instead of a support. I think this goes back a long way, actually. There's a long history of this, as you may be aware, because this goes back to the 50s and 60s. And, you know, the original conflicts between, you know, the Freudian-oriented psychoanalysts of the day and early pioneers in this area, Abram Hoffer, Linus Pauling, and people like that.
Oh, yes, I remember them.
Yeah. So, you know, it's unfortunate that, you know, in the West, we've been trained to set things against each other that really can support each other. You know, one of the advantages of having the background in Chinese medicine is we're trained to see opposites as complements rather than as being as opponents.
yeah.
I think there's a lot of low-hanging fruit here. And the thing I really love about the area is that when we work with nutrients, when we work with substances that are found naturally in the body, I mean, this presents new issues, but some of the issues that working in other ways presents, I'm thinking specifically of pharmaceuticals, tend to go away because we're not altering biochemical pathways with novel substances, with things that have side effects. You know, we're using things that are found naturally there. And so, among other things, this makes it possible to work remotely with people.
Okay, well, before we go there, something I probably should ask you here at the outset is, how have you developed expertise in the area of nutrition? Looking through your book, I don't doubt that you have that expertise, but, you know, people might wonder, well, who is he to say, you know, how I should be eating?
Well, of course, and I understand that. I went off to college in my early 20s intending to be a medical doctor, and that kind of didn't work out. Around the time that it didn't work out, an early food co-op was opening. This was far northern California in a place called Arcata. And I became involved in helping that happen. And I guess that was my introduction to food. I'd never really even considered that the kind of food that I'd grown up with, that there could possibly be anything wrong with it. I was still a few years away from realizing what, you know, my addiction to sugar and refined carbohydrates was doing to me. So that was my initial exposure. And then again, after that period, when I ran into an early orthomolecular psychiatrist. Say that fast three times.
Yeah, right.
An early orthomolecular psychiatrist named Dr. Harvey Bross. And, you know, he listened to my story, and he sent me off to Kaiser, actually, for a blood glucose tolerance test, and it came back, and it was fine. And I'll never forget this moment. He balled it up into a wad and threw it in the trash and said, "I don't care. I'm putting you on this diet anyway." Took me off all refined carbohydrates and a lot of other ones too. You crash and burn when that happens. Coming out of it, I was astonished, and the effect was so profound. It was extremely motivating. Again, it, you know, was the motivation, among other things, for me getting interested in Chinese medicine and acupuncture.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you'll find when you dive into this area that, you know, it's been kind of an academic orphan for two, maybe three generations. You know, Abram Hoffer, Humphrey Osmond, those people, they basically self-banished themselves to Canada because they couldn't find reception for their work here. And we can talk about that if you're interested, because there's an interesting story there too. So you won't find people teaching this in nutrition departments. I've had RD nutritionists come to me, seek me out and say, you know, I have a sense that you know a lot of things they never mentioned in school. And in fact, I do. I live a block from the UCLA Medical Library. I spend way too much time up there. I am on the spectrum, which means I'm a geek. I'm very facile with my computers and my databases. Yeah. And so over the years, I've accumulated a huge mass of information, which I reference in the back of the book, actually, some of it. And I've gotten very adept at putting it together. Now, I'll be the first to say I am not a research scientist of any type. I am a clinician. I'm an acupuncturist. So, you know, it's not normally the case that people with my licensing and my background have this kind of expertise. I'll agree. And, you know, as is sometimes the case with autodidacts, there are often holes in my knowledge. However, I think you'll find that anyone who's really into this area will tell you that when two of us get together, we always have lots of new things to share, because the body is a complex phenomenon. It's dependent on multiple inputs, and it's extremely complex. So there's many different ways to work with these things. And you know, I bring a certain amount of that to the table.
I love your self-description, and I particularly light up to the word autodidact, although I'm not one. But for many years, I was a ham radio operator, amateur radio operator. I don't know if you've ever had any contact with that crowd.
Oh, I have. I bumped it. I had a good friend who was really into that when I was in high school.
There are a lot of autodidacts in that group.
It's a gregarious group of autodidacts, too.
Yes. Yes, right.
Which is unusual.
Yeah. You know, I would be interested in hearing a little bit more about that Osmond and Humphrey story. Were they psychiatrists, if I recall?
I believe Hoffer is, And I'm not sure if Osmond is a clinician. I would have to look that up. He may just be a researcher.
Well, I do Hoffer's remember a period back in the middle 60s or late 60s, early 70s, where there was a lot of talk about the orthomolecular approach, particularly in regard to schizophrenia. And then later, I think that fell into disfavor, or I certainly don't hear people talking about it anymore. And it sounds like you know something about that history.
Well, you know, just first of all, there's a whole generation of new researchers operating these days. Yep. And they're not, they don't seem to be as caught up in some of the old prejudices as earlier generations of researchers. And I can't tell, frankly, as I watch them working, whether they know that they're working their way around to supporting some of Hoffer and Osmond's original concepts or not. And I want to just underline some of those concepts, because for any of your listeners who are already familiar with this controversy, ideas like adrenochrome, for example, haven't panned out, but let's not go there. Hoffer and Osmond, you know, they were sort of the last cohort of that generation of early 20th century researchers that did so much to revolutionize scientific thinking. You know, this was before corporate budgets really took over research, and you had eccentric individuals out there on their own, you know, sometimes working in research departments at university, often doing that, you know, credentialed people, but sometimes working on their own or privately. And they were the ones who discovered the vitamins, okay? They were the ones who made a lot of, you know, the antibiotics, the early antibiotics. You know, these were the outcomes of individuals working rather than teams frequently. And so back in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, we had a huge public health issue in Central America and the southern U.S. People were eating a lot of corn. And they were developing these strange symptoms. Their skin would get flaky. They would have problems with their bones and joints. And they would start losing their minds. They would be hearing voices. They would be having visions. They would be, you know, impossible to reach and talk to, speaking nonsense. Wow. And the name that was given to this disease was pellagra.
Oh, yes. I've heard of that.
Okay, and it took quite a long time, and I'm sorry I don't have the right screen up on my laptop at the moment, but it was in the early 30s that it was discovered that this cause of pellagra was the lack of an essential substance in corn, niacin, vitamin B3. And when you restored niacin to the diet, all of these symptoms went away. People, you know, started talking sensibly and their skin became normal again and they stopped having the pains. And so this was like, you know, for the time, this was a miracle drug, you know, niacin.
Yes.
Now, fast forward to the late 50s, early 60s. We have, you know, processed carbohydrate consumption exploding in the U.S. as, you know, processed foods and fast food starts to take off. People moving to breakfast cereals routinely, processed breakfast cereals. High fructose corn syrup is about to be invented. It won't be, you know, generalized for another 15, 20 years, but they're getting ready. More and more people are losing their minds in exactly the same way that was described in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. They're hearing voices. They're impossible to talk to. They're speaking gibberish. They're, you know. And so Hoffer and Abram asked themselves, could this be a form of pellagra? And they were friends with a guy named Linus Pauling, who was really into vitamin C. And Linus had discovered that higher primates, guinea pigs, and fruit bats, higher primates, of course, including us, are the only mammals that don't create large amounts of vitamin C in our body naturally. Most mammals can take blood sugar and turn it into vitamin C, and take vitamin C and turn it into blood sugar. We can't. We lost that ability, it appears, about 40 million years ago. Apparently, we're surrounded by enough of it naturally that our bodies decided we didn't need to keep making it. We could use that energy for something else. So Hoffer, Pauling, Abrams, they put their heads together and they said, well, they already knew that the brain was composed of cells. And they already knew that inflammation, the action of free radicals on those cells, might be creating problems. So maybe vitamin C would be good for that. They knew that vitamin C was an important constituent of connective tissue. You know, if it wasn't for vitamin C, our bodies would instantly dissolve into a puddle of cells on the floor. So thinking that perhaps what they were seeing was a poisoning of some sort, and that the blood-brain barrier, a thin layer of cells that protects our brains from many of the things swimming around in our bloodstream, thinking they had to strengthen that, and thinking that maybe this was an expression of pellagra, they got the idea of using high doses of niacin and vitamin C to stabilize acute schizophrenics, people who were just experiencing their first episodes. And they thought they saw a pretty consistent success. They wrote that up. And what happened was the medical community was very polarized. You know, Humphrey Osmond and Abram Hoffer, but particularly Osmond, had also been interested in the use of LSD for treating schizophrenia. You need to remember back in these days, they were using electroshock therapy, very crude electroshock, lobotomies, things like that, you know. So, you know, this seemed like, you know, a good way to go. But as a result, they fell on the wrong side of the generation gap, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so they were ostracized. And what happened was other researchers took their protocols, applied them to chronic schizophrenics, and didn't see the results. Now, you know, they wrote that up and said, well, sorry, guys, you know, we can't replicate your results. You know, go get lost. And Abrams, Hoffer, and Pauling said, wait a minute, we never said that we could cure a chronic schizophrenia. We were working on acute cases. And besides, when you use nutrition to approach these things, it's best to use it before the damage is done. You know, waiting, you know, taking the normal conventional medical approach and using these methods to address, you know, chronic established cases. It's a little like never changing the oil in your car and then having the engine freeze one day. Then changing the oil and deciding that since changing the oil doesn't get the engine running again, oil has nothing to do with freezing engines. You know, it's just a basic logical flaw. But yeah. It became the basis for a whole, you know, like I said, several generations of people poo-pooing the whole area. Hoffer and Abrams never gave up, like I said. They went up north and, you know, the whole alternative medicine movement started and a lot of their ideas began to inform the work people like I do.
Yes. Okay. Well, continuing on this thread of the relationship between nutrition and mental health, one of the things that you say is that food can also trigger anxiety and depression. Tell us about that, if you will.
Well, there's a couple different ways that can happen. We are designed to crave carbohydrates. The brain doesn't want to run on anything but blood sugar, and sugar comes from breaking down carbohydrates. So if you really want to understand, we'll get the picture here. It's important to think about where would we get our carbohydrates before farming, before agriculture, okay? You know, I mean, I think sometimes, frankly, David, when we look at food today, we kind of accept the food that we grew up with as normal, don't we?
Yes, we do.
You know, and we kind of think, oh, this is how it's always been, you know, and the way our parents, you know, learned to feed us, the way we, you know, develop our own diets, you know. The thing is, the mechanisms that run our bodies, the mechanisms that run our cells, these mechanisms have been works in progress for 1.5 billion years. And I think it's important when we start looking at the way nutrition affects mental health. You know, a couple of things are important to realize. First of all, you know, the brain is what? It's like 2% of the body's weight and 20% of the body's metabolism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so any issue with nutrition is going to show up there first. It's kind of the canary in the coal mine, okay? If you know what you're looking for and if you know how to make the right connections. So
that's so interesting. I've never heard the brain referred to in that way, but that's a provocative metaphor.
Oh, yes. I don't think we should go down this road too far, but, you know, so often in medicine today, it's kind of like, you know, we're asleep in our beds at night and our guard dogs are barking, you know, out by the fence, you know. And so much of what happens, particularly as reimbursements have been cut. I mean, I'm not dissing on people in the medical profession here at all. You know, I think they're well-meaning people. They're working very hard with not enough. But when you take that a community like that and you cut their pay tremendously, as has been done, they have to work faster. You know, so I'm getting a little off track here, but let's loop back. Okay, so where these tie together is there's no time to really think about or explain these things. That's what I'm getting at here. Mm-hmm. When you're working in a conventional medical model, you have to fix the problem. You basically have to shoot the guard dog rather than going out, you know, getting your flashlight, getting your raincoat on, going out and finding out what the guard dog is barking at. Okay, well, here's what the guard dog is barking at. Our bodies are 1.5 billion years old in terms of their processes. And so you have to ask yourself, where would we get our carbohydrates before agriculture, before fire? Okay. We would get them by pulling leaves off plants and chewing them. We would dig up roots. Okay. Now, I don't know about you. David, I would have to be really metabolically motivated dig up a raw root, you know, wash it off, and without the benefit of heat, bite into it.
Yeah.
You know, think about just living on raw carrots, you know, and we haven't even bred them to be soft and juicy like the carrots are yet, because that won't happen for another 12,000 years. So we are very metabolically motivated to crave these carbohydrates. We have to be. And what's happened, you know, first we started growing food 10 and 12,000 years ago. We grew grain. We started grinding the grains. Why? Because if you grind them up and make them into powder, when they hit your stomach acid, you get a much more rapid rise in sugar. When we get a rise in blood sugar, we get a dopamine payoff. Okay. Dopamine is part of what makes sugar taste so good. Now, your listeners.
Part of the reward system, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Your listeners will be familiar with this. It's the neurotransmitter of falling in love. It's the neurotransmitter that cocaine uses to addict us. Basically, dopamine rewires the central nervous system to repeat whatever behaviors give us our dopamine surges. So when we start pushing the system with something like sugar, several things happen. First of all, you know, if you look at the literature of dopamine, you won't find a lot of dopamine-enhancing drugs used for depression. And you would think they would be, right? Because it raises mood. Why not? Well, because it's hard to control. And excesses of dopamine have been associated with violent behavior and acting out. So it's probably not the neurotransmitter we want to play with if we want to lift people's moods. The second reason is, if you've ever gone much time without sugar and then you have a little, you know how good it tastes those first few bites? Remember?
I don't think I've ever gone that long without tasting sugar.
Well, as a Ben and Jerry's Coffee Heath Bar Crunch fan, let me assure you, at least over here, those first few bites are just, you know, heaven. Yeah. And then it takes a little more to get that same amount of pleasure, doesn't it? You know,
yeah.
And this is true of a lot of pleasurable activities, isn't it? You know, what initially just sent us into ecstasy, you know, if we keep pushing the same stimulus, ultimately it loses its taste a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening is the dopamine receptors reset themselves to be less sensitive. You know, a little like a friend who has a friend in trouble who's calling too much, and after a while they stop picking up the phone every time the phone rings. You know, dopamine receptors also stop taking the call after a while. And this sets the stage for addictions. Okay, you have to push the dopamine harder and harder to get the same amount of pleasure. And because dopamine is associated with violent behavior in some individuals, you can get hostility, you can get anger, you can get acting out. So uncontrolled blood sugar swings is one thing to watch for. And how can therapists, you know, tell this is going on? Well, if you've got someone with a lot of rage, ask them if they've got a sweet tooth. If they do, you know, there may be a connection.
Yeah.
You know, again, I don't know if we want to spend too much time going deeply into the neuroendocrinology of all this. There's more information on my site. If can I mention it briefly?
Yeah, sure.
NaturalStressCare.org has a lot available. There's courses and all of that. Another issue that comes up with food is the whole allergy issue. Have you run into that in your travels, David?
Well, certainly I've been hearing about all kinds of people who these days gluten allergy seems to be the big thing. And of course, we hear about people who are allergic to a variety of things, although not often in a psychiatric or psychological spin.
Well, this was the work of, I think his first name was Richard Feingold. You may remember hearing about Feingold. A lot of parents who have had children with behavioral issues in the 60s and 70s were very interested in his ideas about allergies and reactions to mm-hmm. artificial ingredients, artificial colors and flavors in foods.
Yes.
Think back to the last time you got a cold or a flu, David. How did you feel?
Lousy.
and
I don't have
down.
To think back very far.
What was happening cognitively there?
Well, I've always noticed that when I get sick, I think I start to go towards depression. My thoughts get very dark.
Maybe a little grumpy. You might not want.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
What's going on there is you're experiencing a bit of a cytokine storm. Now, not an actual cytokine storm, which would be a medical emergency, but your immune system is responding to the flu viruses colonizing your body. And one of the things that goes on there is the release of cytokines. Cytokines are signaling molecules, and they basically, you know, they tell the immune system to wake up. They're the guy with the bugle. Okay, da 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 da. Wake up! We've got an assault going on. You know, put on your boots. And the immune system goes out and swarms and starts dealing with the flu. But these cytokines, they seem to have evolved. It's very interesting their effects on us if you think about it, because you know if we're looking at a tribe of humans, you know, 30 related individuals moving together through the savanna looking for their prey. Okay, what? If someone comes down with a flu, do we want that person spreading their flu throughout the whole tribe at the same time?
No, we don't.
So what do we want them to do? We want them to get a little grumpy and depressed and go to their tent and their cave and sleep and maybe spare the rest of us their flu, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's interesting that these cytokines, seem to generate that same kind of behavior. I'm just speculating here. I'm not operating from, you know, peer-reviewed studies, but it's an interesting way to look at it. But in any event, in terms of food, there's many, many, many differences in modern food and ancient food, and one of them is that we can eat the same thing all year round if we want to, can't we?
Yeah, that's an option we have with modern-day supermarkets.
You know, they'll fly it in from the other side of the globe if we'll pay them to do it, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, historically, most foods were seasonal. A lot of foods were seasonal. You know, maybe you could store grains or maybe salt some beets or something, but you'd be eating different things at different seasons. As we get older, our digestive systems weaken. And one of the things that happens is the proteins in the food we eat, they may not be broken down all the way into their amino acid building blocks. Just a little bit of geeky science here. Proteins are amino acids all strung together like, pearls on a chain. So proteins need to break down into their amino acid building blocks so the body can take those amino acids and make its own protein. If our guts weaken as we get older, if we're stressed, which weakens digestion, if we're undernourished, which, you know, I maintain is epidemic in our society, then those proteins may not break down into their amino acid building blocks. They'll get absorbed into the gut. The immune system will see them and go, uh-oh, we didn't make this protein. And some cells will swarm and stick little flags on the offending critters, and then other cells swarm and bathe them in an acid bath of free radicals to dissolve them and get rid of them. This is how the immune system kills something. It bathes them in free radicals and dissolves them. When this happens enough, we call it inflammation.
Yeah.
And inflammation triggers the release of cytokines. Cytokines affect behavior. And let's not even start talking about how the inflammation itself affects the, very delicate structures in our brains, in the cell walls of our brains. That's a whole other way to look at this. There's multiple things going on when we eat something that we're allergic to, but fortunately, it's not real hard to spot when this is going on.
How so?
Well, okay. When the immune system swings into gear like this, the body interprets it as a stressor. And so it releases stress hormones. Now, stress hormones are designed to make us run and fight for our lives. It can sometimes tell you've eaten something you're allergic to by just simply checking your pulse. This isn't a slam dunk. It's not 100%. But if you eat something and then afterwards your pulse is faster, there's a good chance you were allergic to it. But more than that, it's a little easier to look for three yellow flags, okay? And this is based on the idea that when the immune system swings into gear to attack an allergen, the body interprets it as a stressor. Stress hormones pull sugar out of storage so we can run or fight for our lives. Sugar gives us a dopamine surge. Dopamine rewires the brain to repeat whatever behavior gave us the dopamine surge. Often, when we're looking for our allergic foods, we need look no farther than our favorite reward foods.
Yeah, that's something I've heard, and I wondered why that should be the case. But you've kind of given me an understanding of why that could be so.
These are the things we eat every day. That's one yellow flag. Now, these are the things that, make our mouths water as we're opening the package or as we're thinking about them, And if you notice an energy drop or a mood swing within 15 to 20 minutes after eating one of these foods, then there's a good chance you're allergic to it, the real test is to eliminate it from the diet, see if mood's behavior improves. If there's still a question, you can reintroduce it, see if the moods start to swing or the behavior starts to return. And there's a couple things that can mess this up, though. One of them is it can take 2 or 3 days after you've dropped something before you start feeling better. And it can take 2 or 3 days once you reintroduce it before you start feeling worse again. So I've had patients, for example, say, they go on a wheat-free diet. And actually, oatmeal is also a no-no in gluten-free diets. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, lots of people will switch to oatmeal, and that also has gluten. Gluten is gluey. All of those grains that kind of stick together, like, Wonder Bread and oatmeal and stuff like that, that's all got gluten. Rye is another one.
Well, what's the problem with gluten? There seems to be almost a hysteria about gluten these days, and I don't think I've heard, what the issue is.
I'm not sure why so many people would be reacting to it these days. It is an extremely common thing, though, that people report. And just clinically, the reason there's so much buzz about it is because over and over again, we see people eliminating gluten from their diet and doing better. The classic are the irritable bowel people, the Crohn's disease folks. Many of them see that when they eliminate wheat. But for example, my father, he's in his 90s. He's been coughing all his life and taking antihistamines that, we found out after 20 or 30 years gave him kidney stones. He finally turns up allergic to wheat, and anytime he sits down to have a meal, if he eats wheat, he starts coughing like he's going to lose his head. And, we've found that if we take wheat out of his diet, that doesn't happen. Myself, I've noticed if I have wheat in the morning, it's very hard for me to do detailed work. Now, some might say, oh, that's just in his head. But there's enough people saying these things that one has to wonder, why would it be, modern wheat? I don't know. Maybe it's making up such a large part of our diets. Maybe it's so ubiquitous. Maybe it's because we can get it all year round and we eat it every morning. So that just happens to be, and multiple times a day. It tends to be things that we eat all the time that do this to us.
Okay. Well, let's talk a bit about ADHD. I'm sure you must have some observations about that.
Well, yes, I do. You know, I think I've already mentioned that, you know, I myself, you know, found my way into this area by being a huge sugarhead as a kid. I mean, I remember coming home from grade school and digging into boxes of unmade Jell-O eagerly with a teaspoon. I mean, I just cringe when I think
yeah.
about what I used to do. Where have we heard this before? AA meetings, right?
Yes.
You know, and it's interesting actually because there's a lot of crosstalk here. You know, when people stop drinking the alcohol, what do they often start doing? Eating a lot of sweets.
Really? Okay.
There's different addictions work that way. We can often substitute. If we stop pushing the dopamine pathways in one way, we'll start pushing them in another. Well, it turns out that these dopamine pathways also are involved in helping us pay attention to things. You know, we've all had this experience. You know, when something really engages us, it's a highly pleasurable thing, isn't it? You know, it's like we become one with the object of our interest. But when we push the dopamine pathways by eating a lot of sugar or, you know, all the drugs of abuse, they all operate, you know, in much the same way. Alcohol will do much the same thing. The dopamine pathways, they retreat. They become less sensitive. So it takes more stimulation. Well, the problem is, you know, we've got kids in school trying to pay attention to their studies. And, you know, their minds are, you know, there's a lot of competition for their attention. You know, they've got, you know, phones that beep and show brightly colored images that swirl and dance around. We've got, you know, Facebook now, you know, running a constant stream by you when you open your phone. You know, and this is all pushing the dopamine pathways. So by comparison, the things that we have to pay attention to, you know, learn skills to, you know, get along with others, to, you know, become, you know, people with things we can market so we can be employed, so that we can show up for the job on time and do our jobs. You know, all of that becomes harder because the dopamine receptors, again, are less sensitive. So actually a group led by a guy named Richard Johnson at the University of Colorado in 2011 published a very interesting review on this. Because as you may recall, you know, I mean, this has been a hot area for a long time, hasn't it? I mean, parents and teachers have been saying this for a long time, haven't they? That sugar is associated
sugar, yes.
with behavioral issues and ADHD.
Yes, they have.
That, you know, when kids eat a lot of junk, they don't do so well in school, you know. Sorry if I wasn't clear about that. What they did was they, you know, the reason there's been a lot of controversy is that there were studies done back in the 70s that purported to show that if you give children a lot of sugar, it doesn't produce any measurable change in their behavior over placebo. And they went at this several different ways. I don't want to talk about all the different ways, but, you know, sort of emblematic of the problem they had, those definitive studies, the ones where they did double-blind randomized work with kids, both some that, you know, their parents said, hey, we've seen sugar affecting our kids in adverse ways, and then, you know, other kids from the general population. None of that was able to show that giving sugar to kids produced any change in their behavior over a placebo control. Well, guess what they used for the placebo controls?
I'm not sure. What did they use?
Artificial sweeteners.
Uh-huh.
And what Johnson and his team points out is that the artificial sweeteners push the dopamine pathways in the same way that sugar does.
Uh-huh.
So they were changing kids' behavior. They just weren't picking it up with their model.
Yeah.
And you run into this a lot in nutrition research, frankly, and that's a whole other subject of discussion. But anyway, this seminal study by Johnson, and, you know, it's just sad that it hasn't gotten more attention, because he pulls together all of the data so far, making the case that there's a lot of overlap neurochemically between what's going on when people indulge drugs, you know, addictive drugs, and what goes on with sugar. And again, he makes the case that, you know, sugar is the first gateway drug. He goes on further to narrow in on high fructose corn syrup. I'm sure you've been hearing some of the buzz about that too.
Oh, yeah. I try to avoid it myself.
Especially with respect to diabetes. You know, there seems to be a relationship. Who's the guy up in the Bay Area? He's at the University of San Francisco. He's making such a name. I've got it here somewhere. Anyway, he was on 60 Minutes a little while ago talking about how fructose is a particular danger. And here's the issue with fructose. Fructose, as you know, is part of – oh, boy. I'm a clinician, not a biochemist. I believe it's glucose, which is made up of sucrose and fructose, if I'm remembering this correctly. Robert Lustig is the guy. Yeah, he's the guy in San Francisco who's really into this. And he points out that, well, actually, excuse me, Johnson points out that when the body metabolizes fructose, it's a very labor-intensive process. It gets metabolized in a different way than sucrose or glucose. And it drains these cells, particularly in the liver, of ATP, which is the energy currency of the body. You can think of, you know, the body putting energy into little, you know, AAA batteries and storing them away until it's needed. Okay, ATP are the batteries. Okay, well, when we eat a lot of fructose, it depletes that. And our bodies start changing in the way they do business. And one of the things that happens is we get a buildup of uric acid. Now, does the phrase uric acid ring any bells for you, David?
It does. You know, I'm not terribly steeped in biochemistry.
It's okay. It's okay. It's okay. I just get tired of excuse me.
I know you want to make it more of a conversation, and I appreciate that.
There you go. Uric acid causes gout. That's what you're.
That's what you're almost remembering.
Yes.
Sure.
Uric acid causes gout. Guess what the age-old remedy for gout has been?
I don't know.
Cherries.
Say it again. Cherries.
Cherries cure gout. Okay. Well, guess what else uric acid does? It creates hyperactivity. When the blood is swimming in uric acid, it's hard to sit still. We're restless. We can't pay attention. We start tapping our feet. We want to get up and go somewhere. Okay. And, you know, uric acid causes inflammation. It's highly pro-inflammatory. So it starts degrading, you know, those very delicate, you know, cell membranes that, you know, have so much to do with how our brains work. So anyway, just to sum this all up and tie it up into a neat little bow, Richard Johnson and his team appear to have shown to me fairly conclusively that sugar, and especially high fructose corn syrup, may be, you know, the cause of a lot of the issues we're seeing in schools and perhaps in the culture at large. You know, I mean, you know, maybe you've heard, you know, the old saw the way I have that, you know, Americans tend to have short memories for things. This is one of the reasons we get ourselves in trouble, you know.
Sure.
That, we don't remember our history, and so we tend to repeat it. There's a case to be made, and, you know, the fellow who wrote Sugar Blues all those years ago, he also made the case that you can – you know, sort of watch the march of civilization across the globe by noticing where cultures got interested in sugar. And what appears to happen is that when a culture encounters sugar, the first thing that happens is it becomes colonial. It goes out and conquers all the nearby cultures. This happened to the Persians, okay? And then it happened to the Muslims. And then it happened to the Christians who went and took over the New World. You know, you can look at Portugal, Spain, France, Britain in turn, each one of them rising and falling, you know, and you can track their sugar consumption as this happens. Because by the third generation, it's a whole different picture. And now you have all the degenerative diseases setting in. And, the barbarian hordes who haven't had, you know, access to the sugar because historically sugar was very expensive and precious.
Yeah.
They come in and take over and become the new ones, you know.
Well, let me shift the focus just a little bit here because you've pointed out that a growing number of kids who've been on various mind-altering pharmaceuticals since childhood, and I assume you're talking here about medications for ADHD – and you say some of them are bumping up into limits of what those medications can do when they're in their early 20s.
Well, and, you know, since I gave the UCLA talk, there's been a lot of interest in what I have to offer. And frankly, I'm more at home dealing with, you know, more dysthymic type issues, you know, depression, anxiety, that kind of thing.
Okay.
But I've just been inundated with calls from parents who have children who were diagnosed with various things, you know, 8 and 10 and 12 years ago, ADHD, bipolar disorder, you know, autistic spectrum disorders. And they were put on, you know, antipsychotic drugs, you know, atypical antipsychotics, things like risperidone and risperdal and things like that. And what's happening now is that these kids, you know, let me just emphasize, I think that drugs have an extremely crucial role to play in the management of psychological disorders and mental disease. But I'm also aware, from having worked with a lot of people who rely on them, that sometimes over time, issues arise. They may stop working the way that they worked initially. And in the case of these atypical antipsychotics, what appears to happen is you get the development of something called tardive dyskinesia, okay, which is an uncontrollable shaking. And so I've had an opportunity to dig into this over the last month or so, and it appears that what's happening, there's a lot of people looking into this, and there's a lot of studies being published. Glial cells are the white matter of the brain, okay, as opposed to the gray matter, the neurons, mm-hmm. the ones that we've been focused on for decades.
Yes.
And the white cells have sort of been dismissed as being kind of peripheral, you know, maybe not all that important, you know, kind of like the appendix, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, which right. turns out is crucial to the immune system's operation, but let's not go there. they're finding out that the glial cells play crucial roles, say that fast three times, in nourishing and protecting the neurons. Okay, there's a subset of them called oligodendrocytes, I believe, is close to that, that form the myelin sheaths, the insulation over the wires of our neurons. Okay, and the other glial cells, you know, they provide a physical matrix that cushions things, but they also play an important role. There even seems to be electrical fields, subtle electrical fields moving along their surfaces, and there's speculation that these fields may be a form of communication that hitherto has escaped our notice, you know, mm-hmm. that there's more than one way that the body communicates with itself electrically, that not yes. everything goes along the wires, okay? So these glial cells have been neglected all these years. And it turns out that what the atypical antipsychotics appear to be doing is weakening them. And they start leaking very corrosive substances that interfere with dopamine pathways. And so you get these twitches and uncontrollable body movements, which, of course, you know, if you've been a child who's already dealing with hyperactivity and, you know, all the social issues that come with that, and then you start to twitch, it's pretty, you know, disturbing and frightening. And So, you know, I'd be the first to say, and I'm very clear with all of these folks, that I do not know that I have a solution to this. However, it's very interesting that we can look back to 50, 60 years ago, the work that Hoffer and Abrams were doing with niacin, with things like vitamin C. Vitamin C strengthens connective tissue. It's detoxifying. We can give these people essential fatty acids. The phospholipids need to be strengthened in the cell's walls. Things like phosphatidylcholine, perhaps even phosphatidylserine. Large doses of essential fatty acids, DHA, EPA, and things like that seem to be very helpful in stabilizing those cell membranes. And niacin, or in this case, niacinamide, because if you take large doses of niacin, you can get flushes. It can be hard on the liver. But there's another form of vitamin B3, niacinamide, which is much more easily tolerated. And this also seems to be stabilizing these individuals. So again, I'm just in the early stages of working with these folks clinically. I'm insisting, of course, that all of them be working with sympathetic psychiatrists so that things can be, you know, adequately monitored. And you know, I'm not a psychiatrist. I can't give people advice about that. But it does strike me that there's a number of ways that we can support those glial cells, ways that I think are overlooked by many of the people who work with the pharmaceuticals.
Let me just follow up on something that you just said. To what extent have you been able to develop supportive, complementary relationships with medical professionals?
Well, that's tricky. I've been on staff in world-class orthopedic clinics. I was on staff for 3 years in pain management at a place called Curlin Job here in Southern California, where their team doctors to the Lakers, Angels, Dodgers, all of those. But even there, I was working under the fellow who's probably the low man on the totem pole, the neurologist, in a situation like that. And I found out that the MDs there, after a while, weren't even aware that I was in the building. You know, I was helping the problems they couldn't. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're so open to what I do.
And as an acupuncturist, or were you also nutritionally involved?
I was working with both because I found that attending to some of the same dynamics that I now use to work with the mental health, some of those same issues were important with helping people get the best results orthopedically. You know, we're growing the garden here. We're fertilizing the soil. We're planting the right, distribution of plants so that we don't have pests coming in, when we're working on these very basic levels. Now, above that, there's other levels of working that are more specific with nutrition. When you're working on a basic level, you're basically correcting, what I would suggest are epidemic levels of deficiencies in our society today in terms of essential nutrients. But just to loop back, and the bottom line there is, frankly, the lower down the totem pole someone is in the medical hierarchy, generally the more interested they are in me. When I was at Curlin Job, the nurses were all over it. They couldn't get enough. They really wanted to know. And in fact, the head nurse became one of my biggest fans there. But the more seniority the orthopedic doctors had, the less interested they were in what I brought to the table. And unfortunately, I think I see some of that same dynamic in the mental health professions. The MFTs and LCSWs, many of them are quite interested. But, I still have experiences like I had at a dinner party over the holidays last winter, where I was next to a psychologist who blithely informed me that, it had been definitively proven that nutrition had no effect on mental health whatsoever. And I wanted to, run to my car and take my book and throw it at him,
Yeah, right. I can well imagine. Well, you know what? We're getting to a place here where I think we should begin to wind down. So I wonder if there are any final points that you'd wish to make. I know there's a lot that we haven't covered, but any final points you'd like to make about nutrition and the mind without throwing a book at us?
Well, first of all, again, just let me emphasize, I am perfectly aware that what I do is a whole different shtick than what, people who work with process or talk or, somatic work or anything. And it all is important. It all helps address crucial things. We need to be supporting each other and working together as a team, mm-hmm. Not seeing each other as competition. Because, yes. And when people talk to me about nutrition, if they go into their cognitive or emotional issues, I tell them, hey, I am not the guy for this. I do have a website, www.naturalstresscare.org. That's natural stress care with an A, not cure, .org, not .com. There's continuing education classes there. There's a lot of materials that can be reviewed by anyone. I've written a book, Before Meds, After Meds, Complementary and Alternative Medicine for Anxiety and Depression. You can get it on Amazon.com. My name again is Dwayne Law, L-A-W. But you can get a hold of me at naturalstresscare.org if you have any questions. And I'm very interested in discussing these issues with anyone in the psychotherapy, the psychiatry community who's got an interest in them. Because often when we sit down and really put our heads together, we find that we share a lot more. Interests than yes. we're, and there's a lot that we can do together. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit to be picked in this area.
Okay. Well, Dwayne Law, I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. And you're right. There's a lot more to talk about. Maybe someday we can drill down a little more.
Mm-hmm. Man, Dwayne Law sure has a great voice for radio. I have to confess that I'm really out of my depth when we're talking about nutrition and its resulting biochemistry and their effect on the brain. So I probably should give one of those disclaimers that you hear so often on terrestrial radio, that the views of guests on Shrink Wrap Radio do not necessarily reflect the opinions of management. It seems like the science on nutrition and vitamins and supplements and so on is in constant flux, and this is further complicated by what seems like an endless avalanche of diet books with recommendations that are often totally contradictory. As a result, the general public, myself included, are perhaps in a state of shock and awe, which can result in a kind of paralysis. Even though I can't vouch for all of Dwayne's recommendations, I'm impressed that he's a very bright professional who has deeply immersed himself in the literature and sincerely done his best to educate himself about complementary and alternative approaches. Also, to his credit, as you heard me mention in the interview, he's quick to urge people towards psychotherapy if there's any indication that it's needed, and he also does not trash pharmaceutical medications across the board. Also, there's nothing in what he advocates that I've not read in other sources or that have not cropped up in some of my other interviews. For example, I've done two interviews with Whole Psychiatry founder Dr. Robert Hedaya, and I suspect they would agree on many points. Dwayne's book touches on many topics in very readable short chapters. He covers such things as vitamins, micronutrients, trace minerals, vegetarianism, fasting, acupuncture, neural feedback, and other areas that would be of interest to readers or listeners interested in diet and alternative approaches to healing. His book, Before Meds, After Meds, Complementary and Alternative Medicine for Anxiety and Depression, is available in the Kindle store on Amazon for $4.95. And by the way, you don't need to have a Kindle to read Kindle books. I assume you all know that it will be delivered to your computer in a .pdf kind of format if you have the Kindle reader for your device, whatever your device is, whether it's desktop or mobile device. You can read books that way and save some money. Now, strangely, I wasn't able to bring it up when I searched on his name, Dwayne Law, L-A-W. However, it did come up when I put in the book title. I'm sure there'll also be a link off his website, which once again is naturalstresscare.org.
This is Louise from Australia. I recently made a donation to Shrink Wrap Radio because after listening to it for a few weeks and just devouring episode after episode, I felt that it was only fair that I gave something back. So I've just made, on this occasion, a one-off donation, and in the future, I reckon I'll make more donations because Dr. Dave is just such a top guy and the show is really awesome. So if you're willing to think about it, maybe you could make a donation too.
Thank you for that very spirited request for donations, Louise. Folks, Louise has set the bar high. Won't you please listen to her advice and click on that big multicolored support button on our site in the right-hand sidebar. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart. And when you go to the right-hand sidebar on our site to look for that support button, you might also notice that there is a new book at the top of the list of books that are being advertised there. And this new book is titled Mountain Air, Relapsing and Finding the Way Back, One Breath at a Time. And it's by Holly Kinley, M.A., who you might recall as a guest on Shrink Wrap Radio number 309 last June when we were discussing her book on cyberbullying. Well, she's written this new Mountain Air book, and in fact, I wrote an endorsement for her book, and I'll share it with you here. Here's what I wrote. Holly Kinley, psychotherapist and abuse survivor herself, has created a work that is unique in the recovery literature. Her particular focus is on the inevitable relapses along the way to healing. Recovery is not a straight line ascent, but rather a spiral in which the old issues, temptations, and fears come around again, challenging us to meet them at a higher level of functioning. Without going into the history of her abuse, her book is nevertheless a personal memoir out of which she extracts principles that can be generalized to all who are in recovery, inspiring them to take courage. This poetic and nature-infused account should become a standard for all therapists and all in the process of recovery. So if this sounds like something you might be interested in, just click on the book cover in the right-hand sidebar, and it will take you straight to her book on Amazon.com. And do feel free to similarly patronize any of the other authors you see listed there in the right-hand sidebar. If you're new to Shrink Wrap Radio, you might not be aware that we have an app for iPhone and for Android. Just click on the Apps tab on our site for full details. Also, if you're a professional in need of continuing education units, we have an abundance of them through the Zur Institute, and you'll find those under the Store tab on our site. I'm afraid we have no new transcripts to announce, so if you are a listener who committed to doing a transcript, please update me on the status of your work, and if you're interested in volunteering to transcribe one or more episodes, please drop me a line.
Hi, this is researcher, author, and Jungian analyst Richard Creighton, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Richard Creighton, who will be my next guest. And more about that in a bit. First, let's go to some recent emails from our listener community. And we hear from Louise, who in part writes, David, you are awesome. Now, I should preface this by saying that Louise and I have had several emails going back and forth, and so she's responding to one of them when she says, David, you are awesome. She goes on to say, I'm so glad to give you a pick-me-up. As you can probably relate, when you can find meaning in genuinely connecting with others in a positive and supportive way, it really helps to improve the quality of your lived experience. Now that I'm not trying to tap away on my iPhone, I will give you a bit more background, all of which you're welcome to share with your listeners if you think it's worth sharing. And you know, you always take a risk when you send me an email that I'll read it on the air. But I'm happy to have this permission here since it's fairly personal. She says in parentheses, I ended up writing much more than I expected to, so feel free to get through your other stuff before reading it, and I hope it's not too much. She goes on to say, I come from a family who are as creative as they are troubled. I have four generations of mental illness of one kind or another from both parents, the most significant of which are, firstly, my maternal great-grandmother, Isabel, who was originally an actress and after having five children in 6 years was institutionalized in a sanatorium where she died at 87. The second is my sister, who had a psychotic breakdown at 16 and is now very disabled with schizoaffective bipolar disorder. Wow. It has been 20 years since my little sister was put through the ringer of the psych ward after the psych ward, and I vowed to stay away from the mental health profession for fear of what they might do to me. It is only now that I'm 40 and I have explored all I can on my own that I'm seeking answers about my non-neurotypical brain and trying to get some therapy to deal with a combination of my genes and my experiences. The most likely candidates for me are complex PTSD, bipolar, and ADHD, but it's going to take a fair while to get a clear answer because on the surface, I appear so high-functioning, which indeed you do, just given the quality of the letter here and other communications that we've had. She goes on to say, the reality of my life can be far from that, though I have managed to have a happy, long-term relationship with an awesome guy and have many meaningful friendships. I also have an art practice, which I've recently started again, as well as performing in improvised theater. When things are bad, they are pretty bad for me, and my husband pretty much becomes my carer. I have managed to work full-time more off than on for the past 8 years. but I did not really enter the workforce until I was 32. For many years, I was hiding from the mainstream, and it had been a challenge finding my way out into the world. I've been fortunate in that my mother is an amazing facilitator in the modality of nonviolent communication and is very well informed of most other frameworks out there. She and I have talked a great deal over the years, and I've learned and grown and evolved out of my self-imprisonment. What I love about your show is that it has given me some great insights into such a wide variety of modalities, some of which I was aware of and many of which I was not. I can try to stuff out on my own or my various therapists, parentheses. I currently have four, if you can believe that. Oh, my goodness. Close parentheses. And then follow up and read more about people. I find that it is my curiosity which is keeping me going throughout all of this, and though what I have experienced is not nearly as dreadful as what happened to my sister, it has been far from easy. My first psychiatrist essentially dumped me after a few sessions because he was concerned about my showing strong signs of transference. For someone with male abandonment and medical health professional trauma, this was not so great for me. But I've clawed my way out and back into the sunshine again. Often it is just being able to lie in bed in the dark and listen to your show, which has given me the comfort I have needed to know that there are people out there in the world trying to help people like me and my crazy mixed-up family. I have attached one of my recent paintings which reflects this journey of coming out into the light and letting go of avoidance and disassociation and reaching out for help from people who can do what I'm not able to do on my own. And that's signed by Lou. Wow, what a family history you are struggling upstream against. And it does sound like you've inherited, you know, maybe some genetic stuff that's going on there. But you really are emerging into the light. I've really enjoyed the exchanges that we've had via email. They're so energetic and creative, and I've had a chance to look at your art online. So all I can say is thanks so much for taking the time to write and to help out here, and also to encourage you to just keep on your path. Next one says, Dr. Dave, I hope you've been well since we last exchanged emails. I still continue to listen to the podcasts when I have the chance and recommend them whenever I can. Yay. I stumbled upon another potential interview for you today. I'm sure you're still backlogged. Yes, I am. But in case you want to explore the new craze of nootropics and brain optimization through diet supplementation and neurofeedback, Dr. Andrew Hill would be a great start for you. I'm 26, and I can't believe how many of my peers and colleagues, doctors, lawyers, bankers, entrepreneurs, students, are doing anything they can to push their minds to the max and get an edge. Sometimes that means stimulant medications like Adderall, but more and more I find people trying to do it in less intrusive and natural ways. Dr. Andrew Hill is a neuroscientist based in L.A. who specializes in neurofeedback and supplements that optimize the way the brain functions. I just spoke to him on the phone for 30 minutes, and he was tremendously generous with his time and quite an easy conversation. I've listened to a podcast with him as well. And here is a link to the podcast, which basically is http://smartdrugsmarts.com. If you explore that site, I think you'll find the podcast. Anyway, he goes on, just wanted to put him on your radar. As I said, I hope you're well, best. And that's from Charlie Bathgate, who I've heard from in the past. And Charlie, thanks for the suggestion. Yes, I do still have a great backlog of listener suggestions, my own ideas, books from publishers, etc. However, this would really fit in with the nutrition and mental health series that I'm working on currently. I've done two interviews, and I think today's show is one of them. So thanks for sending this along. Good to hear from you. And finally, one more. Hello, I was reading a post on your blog about protecting your children from the dangers of the internet and found it very interesting. Having grown up during the spawn of social media, I've seen many instances of cyberbullying myself and know that there is a need for shedding light on the issue. Anyway, I wanted to reach out to you because I have an article on cyberbullying that would complement yours. If you're interested in checking it out, let me know and I'll send it right over. Thanks. And that's from David. And I did reply to David to send me that article, but I didn't get it. So David, if you happen to be hearing this, please send me that article. Speaking of cyberbullying, I saw a really terrific movie with my son when I was visiting him in Manhattan recently. And I see the movie is in general release. And it's kind of about cyberbullying, although it's much more complex than that would suggest. It's really about all the complexities that have been unleashed, I think, by, you know, this new internet that we have that connects us so easily to so many people in so many different ways, both for good and for bad. So at any rate, the movie is Disconnect. And Dr. Dave, that's the title, Disconnect. And Dr. Dave gives it 2 thumbs up. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And remember that in addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on our site. You can leave voicemails on Skype where I'm ShrinkPod. You can leave voicemail on my message phone at 206-350-9918. You can leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the apps tab on our site. Thanks to today's guest, Dwayne Law, for his insights into the role of nutrition in mental health. My next guest will be researcher and Jungian analyst, Dr. Richard Creighton, speaking about placebos. If, like me, you think you know all there is to know about placebos, you'd be wrong. So I think you're going to want to hear this very important, somewhat surprising, and educational interview. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
This is Grant Strine from Media, Pennsylvania, and you've just been shrink-wrapped.